Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. September 1st marked the beginning of the dolphin hunting season in Taiji, Japan. According to Whale and Dolphin Conservation, this devastatingly cruel practice involves the herding of dolphins at sea, where they are then driven and corralled into the confines of a cove in Taiji. After being held for days in the cove, the dolphins are slaughtered for meat or kept alive for sale to marine parks around the globe. Dolphins can sell for $150,000. Rick O'Berry's documentary, The Cove, brought worldwide attention to the brutal hunts in Taiji. We had Rick on just a couple weeks ago. You can find that show at yourcallradio.org. Video footage in the cove shows blue waters turning to a bloody crimson red. O'Berry's group, the Dolphin Project, is currently in the cove documenting the hunters' activities. As of yesterday, they reported the ninth blue cove dive, meaning no dolphins have been killed yet. Today's guest, Susan Casey, joined Rick O'Berry in Taiji during one of the hunts. In her new book, Voices in the Ocean, she writes, quote, "Within a mile of where we were standing, there were at least four dolphin brokering businesses, each with its own trainers. After their capture, the animals are deposited in holding pens and concrete pools at one of these places and taught some basic tricks. As a result, Taiji is a one-stop shopping destination for anyone who would like to buy a dolphin who is untroubled by the process of plucking that dolphin out of a pool of blood that contains the dead bodies of its entire family," end quote. Taiji was just one stop Susan Casey made on a two-year-long journey around the world to investigate the increasing threats to dolphins and marine mammals and their remarkable intelligence. Susan Casey is best-selling author. Her latest book is Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. It chronicles the threats dolphins face from captivity and the brutal slaughter in Taiji. And Susan Casey joins me in studio. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. Thank you for writing this beautiful and also haunting book. Talk a little bit about how this journey for you began. Your father passed away at age 71, and you were really, really close with him. And you went to Maui on a trip and decided to go swimming off the coast of Maui. Talk about that day, because it was kind of a gloomy day. There was nobody on the beach that day.
Yeah, I had been spending a lot of time on Maui when I wrote my book, The Wave. Several of the characters live there, and I had found it this place of solace. And so when my father died very suddenly, I lived in New York, and I worked at a job in Manhattan, but I would constantly be trying to go to Hawaii because that was one of the few things that made me feel better in the aftermath of his death. And I obviously have spent quite a lot of time in the water. I write about the ocean frequently and have met all kinds of sea creatures, including white sharks and, pretty much everything but dolphins. At that point, I had encountered in my time in the water. And I had driven across Maui on my last day there to try to go surfing at this one spot. And when I got there, the weather was really unenticing, but I was leaving the next day and I decided to go for a swim. And even though conditions were a little bit, ill-advised for doing it, I was by myself. There had been this run of shark attacks. I decided to go swimming because I really didn't care if anything happened to me. At that point, I was numb. And when I got offshore, I did see the large gray body with the big dorsal fin, and immediately thought, oh, and then in the next instance thought, that's a dolphin. And it was a pod of spinner dolphins that kind of came up from below, and I couldn't see them at first. Then I saw them, and they were all around me, and there are these small, shy, cute little dolphins, but they are also incredibly athletic. They can rocket out of the water and make like seven revolutions in the air. So they could have darted away from me, but they had clearly chosen to stay with me, and they stayed with me for quite some time. I had a lot of sort of one-on-one eye contact with them, and it was just transporting. I got out of the water, and I walked back to my car, and I started driving, and all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, for the past 20 minutes, I forgot to feel sad. Hmm. And that was the first time that happened to me in more than a year. And what really got my attention was that feeling never really went away. And after that, I started to heal quite a lot faster than I had before. And,
You said that you actually thought about that experience and those dolphins for months after that.
Yeah, it stuck inside my head and I couldn't figure it out. I'm I think I have a mystical side, but I'm also, I write about science and I'm logical and analytical. And I wanted to understand, okay, why did this happen? What did they do? I can't say the dolphins healed me. It's more complicated than that. And grief is really humbling, and dolphins they're not magical angels or anything like that. But there was something about that encounter that changed me profoundly. And because I spent so much time in the ocean, particularly, I wanted to understand it better.
Now, you're not new to the ocean. You wrote two other bestsellers, Wave and The Devil's Teeth. The Devil's Teeth is about your journey, which turned into somewhat of an obsession, following great white sharks off the Farallon Islands. And so you're no stranger to the ocean, but what was it about that experience that made you want to spend 2 years to really study dolphins?
The mystery behind, when you look into the eye of a dolphin in the wild, somebody's looking back at you. And, we do have empirical scientific proof that a dolphin is it's a who. They have self-awareness. This has been demonstrated in experiments. They have names. They have a signature whistle that they get at birth from their mother or some other mature dolphin in their pod, just like we do. And they keep these distinct identities throughout their entire lives. So, we know that this is true. But, what's the nature of the interaction between us, and why is it so resonant to us? It's not just me. I mean, it's something that people long for, to spend time around dolphins.
And it's so interesting because you point out that as recently as the 60s, most people had never seen a dolphin.
Well, I think, yeah, we had marine parks starting, in the U.S. around 1938. There was a big one in Florida, and that was the first encounter people had. And of course, it was only a small group of people who could make it to that particular park. And then Flipper came along around 1963. And this was all brand new. I mean, scuba had just been invented. Jacques Cousteau had come out with A Silent World, but not that long before. So the ocean was really like this might as well have been the backside of the moon for most people.
And since then, scientists and marine researchers have learned so much about dolphins.
Yeah, and one of the biggest challenges of reporting this particular book was I didn't want to focus just on the bottlenose species, which is, of course, Flipper. And when you say dolphin, people think instantly of the bottlenose. But there are 37 species of oceanic dolphins, approximately. And species designation is kind of a little bit changeable, and five river dolphins. So everything from the very small dolphins, the Hector dolphin, all the way up to orcas, which are the largest species of dolphin. And each one of them has a large body of scientific literature. And so I wanted to digest all of that, this sort of fascinating facts about dolphins, and distill it into a more potent cocktail of what we know and what we still, there's plenty of mysteries to them that we don't know.
That's what I love about it. Before we talk about what's happening in Taiji and the very dark side of this, let's talk about the amazing intelligence of dolphins. And I'm a huge dolphin lover, so I loved reading your book. But I did not know that dolphins have the ability to flip a biochemical off switch to block the progression of type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, there's some new science about the things that they can do autonomously within their bodies. It's really fascinating. That's one of them. If they have an anomaly in their blood sugar, they can literally turn it off, even on a day-to-day basis. So that itself is worthy of a lot more investigation. And then there's this, to me, this is absolutely, it's almost like magic. If they have a giant wound in their body, let's say even the size of a football, a shark came along, took a chunk, you would expect the animal to be in pain. You'd expect infection, hemorrhaging, scarring, deformation, like a hard time surviving that kind of thing. Dolphins have none of those problems. They appear to have no pain associated with it. So scientists think they may have a natural morphine within their own tissues that they can avail themselves of. They don't get infected. It's almost like regeneration rather than repair. So there is the idea that dolphins might be generating the stem cells to replace various injured tissues themselves. They can actually rebuild that themselves, and that they may be, in fact, also extracting my antimicrobial and antibiotic compounds from the ocean, from plants in the ocean, storing it in their bodies, and then trotting that out when they need it. Mm. I mean, it's just astonishing.
So amazing. You also report that dolphins can see with their hearing, deploying biological sonar to effectively produce X-ray vision. Dolphins can literally see through objects.
Yeah, and they have the highest powered sonar, I mean, far more powerful than anything we can concoct, and they developed it over the course of about 20 million years. So it's very refined. It's exquisitely attuned, and a dolphin can send out 2,000 clicks a second in its active sonar and then aim and adjust the frequency and the direction of each click individually. It's astonishing. They can find fish under the sand. They basically, like when you think of going to the doctor and having an ultrasound, they can do that, but at a much more powerful level.
Mm. They can communicate at frequencies nearly an order of magnitude higher than anything humans can discern and navigate electrical and magnetic fields that are interceptable to us. And they can stay awake and alert for 15 straight days.
Yeah, they're air-breathing mammals who live in the water. So one of the big differences between us and them is that they don't breathe automatically. They have to decide to breathe. So if a dolphin is unconscious underwater, he will drown. That's one of the things that they do. If they're injured, the other dolphins in the pod will lift the injured animal to the surface so he can breathe. And the staying awake and alert part makes sense when you think about that, because if they ever fell asleep, they could drown. So their brain hemispheres work independently. And when a dolphin is sleeping, one half of his brain is always awake. So he's at least partly awake.
And you sought out an interview with a neuroscientist who's now one of my new sheroes, Lori Marino. She's a neuroscientist in Utah, and she has published hundreds of papers about the intelligence of dolphins. She now also advocates for the humane treatment of all animals. She's adamantly opposed to captivity. When did you first learn about Lori Marino?
Well, I started to see her name throughout the scientific literature. She's a really prolific and well-respected, really eminent scientist, and her field was neuroscience, neuroanatomy, and biopsychology, like how the anatomy of the brain informs behavior and vice versa. But instead of working with primates, which many neuroscientists choose to do because we're primates after all, she chose cetaceans, a completely different evolutionary path to intelligence. And so, there aren't that many cetacean neuroscientists in the world, and she's one of the best. So I was fascinated, but I just kept hearing her name all over the reading it, and everything she had to say was fascinating. I'm with you. I just think she's the bee's knees.
So what did you learn from her, and what does she think about where we are today, where on one hand we are so fascinated by these magical, amazing creatures, and on the other hand, and we'll talk about this later, the demand for captive dolphins is on the rise around the globe?
Well, so the thing that is interesting about Lori, she and another scientist, Diana Reese, in 2000 conducted an experiment that showed that the dolphins are self-aware. They look in a mirror and they using experimental protocols where they mark them with a bright mark of some kind, and they then present them with a mirror and watch the animals sort of moving their bodies to see, and it indicates that they can tell that it's them in the mirror, that the mark is on them. What is it? And interestingly, most animals don't understand that they can't make that cognitive leap to the idea that it's them. They proved that dolphins can do that, and this was the first time anybody had proven that outside of the great ape family, so it was a big deal. But once she learned that the dolphins were conscious of their situation, they knew they were captives. They knew that they were not with their families. They knew all these things, she couldn't anymore sort of support the idea of working with them in captivity, and she really walked that walk.
How have other scientists responded to that, and is that really unusual for a scientist who studies dolphins to say, I will not study them when they're in captivity?
Well, you know, Lori, I spent a lot of time talking to her. I could have spent years more, but her whole thing was she never wanted to do a lot of the things that scientists are routinely asked to do in their training. Like, she turned down a full scholarship at Princeton because she was going to have to vivisect cats. And, you know, she told me that you can order mice on Amazon, and there's a lot of genetic testing that goes on. And she didn't want to do that. She wanted to help other scientists find a path to real science that didn't involve these things that were hard on the soul, you know. And for her in particular, she being a neuroscientist had looked at these brains and thought, there are no dumb creatures. They're all, in their own way, extraordinary, and they feel pain, and they understand that they're suffering. I mean, it doesn't need to get any clearer than that. But I do think it was a... I do think some scientists sort of rolled their eyes at the idea that a scientist can also be an activist in some way. She wants to prove that that's possible, and I think she is doing just that.
I'm speaking with Susan Casey about her new book, Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. Susan was lucky enough to travel around the globe for 2 years to explore the nature of dolphins, these remarkable creatures, and their complex relationship to humanity. So what questions do you have about the intelligence of dolphins? Have you ever swam with dolphins? What was that experience like? And then we'll also talk about the increase in demand for captive dolphins around the globe. What are your thoughts on these swim with dolphin programs? They're happening here in the United States. Of course, SeaWorld is getting so much attention because of blackfish and their captive orcas and dolphins. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. What do you think we can do to protect dolphins? Again, the hunting season in Taiji began on September 1st. Luckily, no dolphins have been kidnapped or killed, but it is only 9 days in, and I'm sure it's probably going to happen in the next couple of days. So what are your thoughts on efforts to protect dolphins? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So let's talk a little bit about what we're facing around the globe. Where is captivity on the rise? Like, what is the status right now of these swim with dolphin programs, these dolphinariums? It seems like it's going down in the U.S. because of increased awareness, but there's an increase in other countries.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard numerous anecdotal stories about children not wanting to go to these programs anymore and telling their parents, no, don't take me there, or in fact being taken in and then somehow being upset or lobbying their class not to go on field trips. So I do think the awareness in the U.S. is rising, and kids are smart, too. They can feel the vibe. In the Caribbean, the Swim with Dolphins programs are cropping up a lot. I forget the exact statistic. It might be two per month opening.
Wow.
And they tend to open where cruise ships disembark. And, I mean, these are very lucrative businesses, and the dolphins come from all over the place. They come from Cuba. They can come from elsewhere in the Caribbean. They can come from Taiji. They can come from the Solomon Islands and both places that I went. So there doesn't seem to be a problem getting dolphins. But, you know, in the U.S., yeah, I think you're right. I think that there is a sort of increasing awareness of what's going on.
Right. So two a month in the Caribbean. I've also read that there's an increase in demand in Russia, China, and the Middle East.
I've read that too. I don't know the exact statistics, but clearly there's still demand. And in Japan alone, there's 51, I mean, a country the size of California, there's 51 what they call dolphinariums, some sort of swim with dolphins programs or dolphin petting zoos or those kind of things.
And what are the laws around this? Because again, we are talking about humans physically taking dolphins out of the ocean and then flying them, in some cases, halfway around the world to go to these parks.
Well, I mean, you know, lots of countries have outlawed the capture of dolphins within their own waters. I mean, the U.S. has, and Mexico has, and lots of places they have protections against this for the animals, but not everywhere. There's a lot of loopholes that can be exploited, and, I mean, clearly there's Taiji dolphins have ended up all over the world.
So let's talk a little bit about what we know about the dolphins once they're captured. You were in Taiji. You did not see a capture, but I'll ask you to talk about just what it looks like there and what it feels like there. But what is the process involved? What does just the capture of the dolphin do?
Well, the way they do it is by using sound to disorient the dolphins. And I guess underwater, it's the equivalent of, it's almost like a physical wall. They make by banging on these metal poles. It drives the dolphins into this cove. Actually, it's a series of coves. And both of the places that I went to, both Taiji and the Solomon Islands, where they do dolphin drive hunts like that, they are aided by the geography of the shoreline. I mean, this is a natural cove place to, and then they can net off this entrance, and it's a narrow entrance. So then the dolphins are in there, and they're very disoriented. You know, the sound really disrupts how they're navigating, how they're communicating, everything like that. So they huddle within the cove, and then over the course, depending on what kind of dolphin it is, if it's bottlenose, there may be a marine park selection process that might last for a couple of days, where you see all kinds of people in the water with the dolphins, trainers checking them out, and I mean, it's quite a brutal end. You can hear the dolphins, you know, vocalizing. They're in distress. I mean, they're scared. And if they're left in there for a couple of days, they become dehydrated because they extract, they need fresh water just like we do, and they extract it from fish. So if they're not eating, they're getting increasingly disoriented and dehydrated. And then, of course, they're led into this other area that's now obscured from view, where they're slaughtered.
You write that when you were in Taiji, within a mile of where you were standing, there were at least four dolphin brokering businesses, each with its own trainers. What is a dolphin brokering business? How does that operate?
Well, you know, it's if you want to buy a dolphin, that's who you call. And I mean, there's a lot that goes into, obviously, transporting, getting a dolphin from this little town in Japan into the, you know, the dolphinarium in somewhere in rural China. You know, so that's what a dolphin broker does. And it's a very lucrative business. In the center of town, there's this building called the Taiji Whale Museum that is actually a whaling museum. And you see all throughout this sort of quite beautiful coastline, like rugged, and it's a World Heritage Site. I mean, you see these floating pens all over the place, and you see these cruddy little sort of concrete, I don't know, the whole place, you can see that it's set up for this sort of you know, these holding tanks for dolphins that are for sale.
Well, we have a question about captivity. Let's go to Suzette in Berkeley. Hi, Suzette. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Rose. Thank you, Susan. First of all, just quickly, I wanted to say, Susan, I read your other two books, and I'm in the process of reading The Devil's Teeth again. I think I'm somebody like you that's infinitely curious about the natural world, and I really appreciate the way that you write about it in a scientific, intelligent, but accessible way. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I have not read your latest book, but I'm waiting for it, and I would love to have a whole conversation with you. But just quickly, I wanted to say I am a little older than you, and I have grown up with the water. I'm the daughter of a sports fisherman. Everything in the water excites me. I grew up here in the Bay Area. But the idea that somehow we must, as a species, be entitled to swim with dolphins or whales, I think, is nobody's business. I think that speaks to the terrible aspect of our culture at this point, that we as people must have access to everything, the top of Everest, swimming with dolphins in Las Vegas or whatever else it is. So I'm completely against that. However, I wanted to ask you, and maybe this is an ignorant question, but again, I haven't read your book yet, your newest book. Why, if they are so intelligent, how is it that, I think I may know the answer now after just listening to you, but why is it that they cannot leap out of the nets that they are being caught?
Yeah, you know, it's a fabulous question. It's kind of a lengthy answer. And also, just before I do that, I just want to tell you that I agree with you on your observation of, you know, we have some evolving ourselves to do as a species to be able to respect, you know, the other intelligent life on this planet. And we have so much knowledge. We've never had so much knowledge at our fingertips. But how are we going to translate that into wisdom? And to me, you know, we have this 55-million-year-old big brain, and ours is not even two.
And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, and then you can answer the rest of Suzette's question right after this.
And you are listening to Your Call on KALW in San Francisco. General Manager Matt Martin here with Joe Burke, taking just this regular break in the program to ask for your support during our September membership campaign.
800-525-9917 is the number we invite you to call this morning. You can also join KALW on our website, kalw.org. It's just a click away.
That's right, KALW.org, where you can see information about Susan Casey's book, Voices in the Ocean. This is brand new, and it's yours for a $120 contribution to KALW. Our thanks for your support for these kind of conversations. Rose and her team have kept the questions both about the other intelligent life forms on the planet and the ocean in front of you and on the airwaves here at Local Public Radio. Your support right now will keep those conversations going. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
Your support is the only thing that actually makes these conversations happen.
Yep.
Join Local Public Radio and help support a station that brings you programming that you can really sink your teeth into. You can take time to enjoy a conversation and join in it with Rose and her guests. Here's your opportunity to support Local Public Radio and your call.
800-525-9917, KALW.org. It's all about having a greater knowledge of the world around us so that we can be intelligent participants in it. Your support makes that happen. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. We're going to go back to Rose and Susan Casey in just a moment to show your support now.
800-525-9917. And as Matt mentioned, for a pledge of just $120, Susan Casey's Voices in the Ocean is our thank you gift to you for joining Local Public Radio.
800-525-9917, KALW.org. Thanks to everyone who's already got involved in this campaign. The momentum is strong. Help us keep it going. We won't be back asking for your support until May of next year.
800-525-9917. Rose?
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, I am joined by Susan Casey. She's out with a new book, Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. After an amazing experience of swimming with dolphins in their natural habitat, the ocean in Maui, she set off on a two-year worldwide journey to study dolphins and look at these remarkable creatures and their complex relationship to humanity. So what questions do you have about dolphins? Their intelligence is amazing. I just want to bring this one up one more time. Did you know that dolphins have the ability to flip a biochemical off switch to block the progression of type 2 diabetes? They also have bigger brains than we do. We can actually learn a lot from dolphins. There's a very dark side also to our relationship with dolphins. Dolphins are being slaughtered and kidnapped around the globe, specifically in Taiji, Japan. The ones that are kidnapped are sent to dolphinariums and dolphin shows, dolphin swim with dolphin exhibits around the world. And as Susan just pointed out, they specifically happen where cruise ships port. So, for example, in the Caribbean, there are lots of swim with dolphin opportunities. So what are your thoughts on that? If you've ever done that, we'd love to hear from you. Why did you do it? What was your experience like? And what do you think of it when, you know, you learn about what the intelligence of dolphins? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So you wanted to answer Suzette's question. If dolphins are so smart, how do they end up being captured so easily?
Yeah. When you see the cove and you see the nets and you know what dolphins are capable of doing, I mean, they can jump very high. I don't even know how high, but like at least 20 feet into the air. It would be a matter of nothing whatsoever to a dolphin to jump that net. So why don't they do it? Why don't they attack? Why don't they, you know, there's a lot of things that we don't understand. Why do they beach, strand, the entire pod strands when only one or two animals might be sick? You know, so the explanation for why that might be, which is at this point sort of a hypothesis because we don't really know, is found in the structure of their brains. They have, you know, two hemispheres in their brain, just like us, but that's where kind of the similarity stops. They're wired completely differently. And one part of the brain that is particularly developed, overdeveloped almost comparatively with ours, is in the limbic area, and they even have an extra lobe. This is the seat of emotions in the brain and feeling, and it was explained to me by the neuroscientists that this suggests that they're doing something very sophisticated with their emotions when they're processing their emotions. It also indicates a sort of extreme connection with one another, and I'm glossing over the details of this because it's pretty complicated, but the dolphins, when they perceive the world, may have a slightly different sense of themselves than we do, mm-hmm. where there is a tighter connection that extends even past the perimeter of their own physical being. So they're more like there's a sort of a meta self to the pod. And so the idea would be that it's not like every dolphin for himself, like the way we think, like, I just have to save myself. Their brains don't enable them to make that sort of let me just save myself kind of, it's all or nothing. It's all for one and one for all. And they call this the communal self. It's a very intriguing idea. It's one of the most fascinating things I came across in the research. And of course, you know, how do you ever prove this to be true? But those are behaviors by dolphins that at present we don't have a really logical way to explain.
So it's so collective, and it makes, you know, just the thought of the dolphins being separated and then captured and forced to live in a pool for the rest of their lives away from their family just makes it even worse. I'm looking right now at some of the photos in your book, and you have this photo of Rick O'Berry, Flipper's former trainer, who's now devoting his entire life to this issue. And in this photo, he is shown with Angel, an albino bottlenose calf whose mother and podmates were killed in the annual drive hunt in Taiji.
Yeah.
Talk about how that happened and what is the status of Angel today?
I believe Angel is still in that tank, and she's in there with two dolphins from another species. She's both blind and deaf. When she was captured, she was extremely young. She was clinging to her mother. It was in a large roundup of bottlenose dolphins. I believe there were more than 300 of them. It was more than one pod. And a lot of the dolphins were captured. Somebody like Angel, of course, was a prize. They love these sort of strange, unique dolphins that people will pay admission to come and see. And that Taiji Whale Museum where she lives is filled with exotic dolphins because the Kuroshio Current comes so close to the tip of Japan there that these guys in their little fishing boats can encounter and capture these deep water dolphin species that you don't see very often. Like when I was there, I saw a false killer whale, and they also had a pilot whale. They had white-sided dolphins, none of which are in any way suited to be to life in a tank. And throughout history, they've been kept in marine parks because they're unusual. And all dolphins species, they look different, some of them radically different. And people come to look at them, but they don't last very long, so they aren't held now. However, in Taiji, of course, they just restock them. They don't care. They just bring them in and out of that whale museum.
What do we know about the effects of captivity? You write about boredom, which is one culprit. You write that if your entire world were a featureless swimming pool, you would probably take great interest in examining the stuff people tossed in. For a creature as smart and creative and sociable as a dolphin, there's an undeniable padded cell quality to life in a blank white concrete tank. Behavioral biologist Tony Forhoff, who studies stress in captive dolphins, has watched the animals gnaw on cement enclosures until their teeth are ground down and bang themselves repeatedly against the walls. They're completely stressed out. They develop ulcers. They have heart trouble. The list goes on.
They react like we would, I think. And a lot of the times you hear a marine park say, you know, that's nonsense. They're treated like luxuriously, they don't have to hunt. I mean, dolphins live to hunt. They have such specialized cooperative hunting techniques. Like, that's the dolphin's world. Hunting with other dolphins, using the sonar to find the fish, it's all gone when it's in a tank. None of the adaptations, none of their abilities are available to them. You know, I often say, yeah, okay, maybe they're getting great veterinary care. And maybe, you know, they're fed dead fish in a marine park. They hunt live fish in the ocean, but let's just say it's the most delicious. Let's just say it's sashimi coming from room service at the Four Seasons Hotel. After a while, I don't want to live in a hotel room. I don't care how nice it is.
I'm speaking with Susan Casey about her new book, Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. What questions do you have about the intelligence of dolphins, about what captivity does to dolphins? If you've had a personal experience with dolphins, we'd love to hear from you. And what about protecting dolphins? What will it take to end the slaughter? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So tell us about the time you spent in Taiji, Japan with Rick Berry and the activists that now travel to Taiji from around the globe to raise awareness about what's happening. Most of the dolphins are actually slaughtered. One of the spokesmen you wrote about in your book referred to dolphins as the cockroaches of the sea.
Yeah, he was actually speaking about dolphins and whales in the context may have been more whale-like than dolphin, but that's the basic idea, is that they need to get rid of as many cetaceans as possible because they eat too many fish. Science has actually proven that to be utter gibberish. There's been papers that have shown that, you know, what really produces a productive ocean is a fully functioning ecosystem with lots of predators in the role that nature intended them. Whales in particular mix the layers of seawater, which are, you know, are not necessarily, they're on thermoclines, and that mixing actually helps the ocean sustain all kinds of growth within it. So not only is there is this notion that the fewer whales and dolphins we have, the more fish we're going to have wrong, it's also, it's illogical.
And so that is their main argument. They're killing, slaughtering these dolphins because they're eating too many fish in the ocean?
I don't know if that's their main argument, but certainly one of the arguments. And it comes up time and time again. They've referred to their hunt as pest control. I think another reason for the hunt is just not wanting anybody to tell them what to do when it comes to how they ply the oceans. I mean, you know, bluefin tuna are on the brink of extinction. They don't want the quotas to go any lower on that. I mean, as if we have any, I mean, it's a little bit odd to me to think that you wouldn't want to fish sustainably if your whole cultural, there's a big cultural connection to the bluefin tuna and just to tuna in general, that's really stressed because of the industrial fishing methods. And so there's also that. And I think just there's a real nationalistic sense of don't tell us what to do.
What was it like for you when you got to Japan and you were on your way to Taiji? What do you have to go through to actually get to the cove?
Well, it's a beautiful part of Japan. I mean, it's just surreal, as the cove showed, because it's so beautiful. And I mean, I wanted to go. I went back with Rick O'Berry and a group of activists who are all inspired to go there after seeing the cove. So it was this beautiful demonstration of how information translates into action and how these things really matter, this communication of like that comes from a movie like The Cove. And when you get there, there's just this weird sense of malevolence. You know, there's a real hostility towards anybody who's coming, particularly around September 1st, which is the start of the hunt. There's always a big clash with the nationalists and, you know, people who are very angry, like, there's the fishing community there's only a small group of people conducting the hunt, but the town itself sort of has closed ranks around this. The whole world reviles this practically, and yet, you know, it has only served to make them just try to obscure what they're doing and to dig in even deeper. It's very odd.
What do you think will stop this? Because the cove raised so much awareness about what's going on in Taiji, Japan, but here we are. I mean, the hunt started on September 1st. Again, luckily, no dolphin has been killed or captured yet, but it is just day 9.
I mean, other places in Japan that have conducted these hunts, Taiji's only one town. There are lots of other towns in the past. Some of them have actually hunted the dolphins to the point where they don't have any dolphins anymore. And one hopes that won't happen in Taiji. But, you know, they are capturing fewer dolphins, selling more, killing less. I think the captivity trade and stopping the growth of the captivity trade is an important part, because the economic underpinning has got to be the sale of that $150,000 bottlenose dolphin as opposed to the $6 pound of mercury-riddled dolphin meat that results from a slaughtered animal. I mean, even the Japanese themselves are, I think the cove helped raise awareness that whale and dolphin meat, because it's so fatty, it's like a sponge for all the most persistent toxic ocean pollutants, things like PCBs, DDT, of course, neurotoxins like mercury. Like you don't want to be eating dolphin and whale meat, even if you think you want to.
And that's still being sold in Japan.
Oh, yeah. No, I went to some dolphin and whale restaurants, and I was told that not that many people are eating that meat anymore, and they do have a surplus of whale meat that they keep, you know, and it may be true that there are fewer people eating it now, but there was certainly in the restaurants I saw, there were people eating it.
And there are a lot of activists now in Japan who are also fighting against this and trying to raise more awareness.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pressure, as much as it seems to just go on and on and on, and I look at Rick sometimes and I see how tired he is of having to go there every single year and go through this thing. It's just a grind. It's really hard, and yet I think that pressure and that bearing witness, is really important. And if you follow them on social media, I think what they're doing, that's, it's all part of it. And the awareness within Japan too, and hopefully the Japanese people who may not know what's going on at the Cove will start to become increasingly aware and will speak up themselves.
And again, Rick O'Berry is a former flipper trainer turned dolphin advocate. He and a number of international volunteers are now in Taiji, Japan, along with volunteers with the Sea Shepherd. And you can follow their Facebook and Twitter feeds. They post videos, they post photos, and every night they'll say whether the Cove is red or blue. Today I am speaking with Susan Casey. She's author of Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. Susan is also author of two books, The Wave, In Pursuit of the Freaks and Giants of the Ocean, and The Devil's Teeth, A True Story of Obsession and Survival Among America's Great White Sharks. Her latest is Voices in the Ocean. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Robert in Oakland. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Once I sailed with two others from Hawaii to San Francisco. That would be about a three-week trip. And about a week from Hawaii, we were motor sailing through the Pacific High, which is an area that has very little wind for a number of days. And we ran over this very large, like a cubic yard patch of netting and a rope that snarled around the propeller and shut down the engine. So I had to dive without any equipment overboard. I had a safety line on, and after the second dive trying to cut this stuff from the propeller, I felt a hard yank on the line, and I hit my head on the hull, and as I came up about cursing at my crewmates, they yelled, "Sharks!" And I climbed up the ladder as fast as I could, and just as I looked over my shoulder, I saw jumping out of the water were not sharks, but two dolphins. And they were a great comfort at that time. The whole trip otherwise, we didn't see any during the entire trip, but they were most welcome at that time. And I had understood that they were enemies of sharks as well. So somehow they came at the right time.
I mean, what an interesting juxtaposition, because I know that area of the Pacific, the gyre that you're talking about, I've wrote about the Eastern Pacific garbage patch, you know, where all the plastic is pooled in the currents. And it is really the doldrums of the ocean. There's not a lot of life there. So the idea of seeing dolphins in the midst of that would be both unusual and special. And also, I think, I honestly, like, when I reported that story about the plastic in the ocean, it changed me in a way that almost no other story I've ever reported has. Like, and then I just started seeing plastic everywhere in our world. Mm. And when you learn about how long it takes to all the plastic that has ever been created in the world still exists, and most of it ends up in the oceans. We can't really melt it. It off gases with toxins. Like, we need to learn how to use plastic for the most durable things that we need in our society, not the most disposable. I mean, what an amazing, like, sort of emotional whiplash experience that must have been.
You probably heard about the new study that came out of Australia that found 90% of seabirds have consumed plastic, and by the year 2050, 99% of seabirds will have gobbled down plastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the food chain, and you know, the same with fat in the dolphin and whale's bodies. Petroleum-based plastics, they're oily, so they're lipophilic. These chemicals, like the very toxic chemicals, they bind to them, so they become tiny little pieces. In that area of the ocean that the caller was talking about, they found that there are six times more plastic by weight than plankton, and it gets mixed in. And so these chemicals then end up in the food chain.
Well, thank you for calling in, Robert. Let's go next to Glenn in San Francisco. Hi, Glenn.
Hey there. Hey, I was just listening to your talk, and it just reminds me of these dolphins evolving for millions of years and pretty much being more advanced than we are, just because they don't have hands besides that. And it has to do, I think, with the human being. If you don't respect your own kind and treat your own kind with, you know, goodness and fairness, it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to be treating other majestic, incredible, equal, or greater entities well, if you can't do it with your own people, you know. The first thing that thoughts pop to mind is, wait a minute, you know, we're treating these majestic creatures like wolves, killing them, make justifying it, but then again, we're doing the exact same thing to one another. So we have to remember, you know, we're doing it across the board, and you can almost get more, you know, people to raise their eyes and say, look, we're killing these gorgeous dolphins, and they'll say, yeah, stop killing the dolphins, but, you know, solitary confinement's okay. So it's kind of like until we get out of doing what we're doing to ourselves, you know, good luck in applying this to other magnificent creatures greater than ourselves. That's kind of my point.
Yeah, I think that's a really, you know, at the same time, it's like we don't play well with others. And we're one of the characters I found so fascinating in the book was John Lilly, the neuroscientist who, I think more than anybody, was responsible for raising awareness of the intelligence of whales and dolphins, even though, you know, his career was both colorful, brilliant, and highly eccentric. You know, he has this phrase where he, after studying dolphin brains, said, you know, we're babies in the universe. And I named a chapter after from that quote because I think that's, for us, the big challenge is, you know, how are we going to get along, not just, of course, as you say, with nature, of which we're a part, but with ourselves. Like, this idea of the communal self, it is the kind of adaptation that you can imagine us having as a species if we managed to stick around. If we cared more about one another because we really understood that we were connected, we would have a better chance at living in harmony with everybody and everything. And I looked really hard in the book for examples of where this had happened in the past, and I found what I believe is one in about 3000 BC. And, you know, I do think it's up to us. There's a moment of reckoning here. How are we going to move forward? If we can't thrive at the expense of the natural world, or, you know, by preying on one another.
The awareness is being raised because of documentaries like Blackfish and The Cove and people like you spending 2 years and researching the dolphins. There's so many different levels to this. I mean, what would you say to people who, for example, dolphins are captive at the Mirage Hotel in Las Vegas, and people see them. They pay money to swim with them, as you did, to do your research. What would you say to people who, you know, might want to do that, to learn more about dolphins?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of scientific aquariums. I love the Monterey Bay Aquarium. You don't see dolphins swim with dolphins or dolphins doing tail walking or, like, tricks and things like that. And I also really applaud the National Aquarium in Baltimore, which has stopped their dolphin show, deeming it antiquated. You know, we know better. They have 8 dolphins, and they're taking care of those dolphins, and they let people come in, and they convey real science to them. So my feeling would be, if you want to be around dolphins, you want to see them, check your own moral compass and go to a place where, you know, either you're on the deck of a whale watching boat and you're seeing them in the wild, or you're, you know, in a place like the National Aquarium Baltimore, where you can tell that the intention is education and not entertainment. And if you really feel that you must swim with dolphins, I would say there are places in the world where you can swim with them in the wild in a way that does not harm the dolphins.
And they choose if they want to swim with you,
and they choose.
Right?
Dolphins have a lot of room to move around in the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
And the place that I have gone, and I think it's done very consciously, is on the Kona coast of Hawaii. In particular, you know, the diving, there's several groups there. They all are very conscious of how they convey the science. They give real biological information about wild dolphins. There's no misinformation. And all that information is in the appendix of my book. So,
and we were talking before the show, right now, go to Moss Landing and go on a whale watching trip in the Monterey Bay. You are guaranteed to be surrounded by hundreds of dolphins and whales.
It's a far better educational experience for somebody to see them in the wild where they belong, and to see the entire ecosystem at work, the seabirds, you know, the everything. I mean, it's magical out there.
Well, thank you for giving these magical creatures a voice. Susan Casey is the author of Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. And if you are free tonight, Susan will be speaking at the Goldman Theater, the David Brower Center over in Berkeley at 7 o'clock. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Susan, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. It's your call.